Good morning, guys. Thanks for coming in and listening to us. We're going to be talking about the communities about some of these open source projects. We're focusing on cloud native, which basically means we're talking about Kubernetes, Cloud Foundry, and Mesos. Just as a disclaimer, we're not going to be talking about the technologies themselves. We're trying to compare what is the open source process like, what does it mean to be a part of these projects. And the idea really is we hope that you guys, if you choose to contribute to an open source project yourself, we'll give you kind of the tools or the things to look out for and make sure you're picking a project that works for your development style and your kind of values. How do you see code should be going in and out? So this is Morgan. I'm Swetha. Just to kind of give you a little bit of an outline of what we're going to talk about, we'll start off with some introductions, tell you who we are, why we're talking about this a little bit, and why, you know, we think we should be talking about this. Then we're going to start off talking about Mesos, then go into Kubernetes, end up with some info about Cloud Foundry. And then at the very end, because we both work for IBM, we're going to talk a little bit about IBM Cloud.
My name is Morgan. I work at IBM. I started a couple years ago in open source working on Docker. I became a Docker maintainer on the engine and the old version of Swarm about 6 months after that. Did another year and a half or so of Docker membership and Docker code maintenance, merging things, reviewing things. Then went to work on Kubernetes and sort of affiliated projects there. Couple more months in that project to become a basic member. One of the sort of founding members of the Service Catalog project, SubSig. And recently I've transitioned out of Kubernetes, but I've built up a couple of years of experience there as well. And so I hope to give some of that to you today.
So I already introduced myself briefly, but my name's Swetha. I also work for IBM. I joined our current team a little around the same time Morgan did, and I've been involved in open source since then, so it's about 3 years now. I used to work on a project called Cloud Foundry. There I was a full committer, worked around, if you're familiar with that project, it has quite a few teams and stuff, so I got to work on quite a few of them. And then about a year ago, I switched over to Hyperledger Fabric, which is a blockchain platform. And over there, I am a maintainer of the Fabric Chain Code EVM, which is basically our integration of the Ethereum virtual machine. So feel free to come talk to me about that after the presentation or at the booth if you find me. So if you looked at the schedule before you came in here, you would have noticed there was a third speaker. I did want to give a shout out to these people. Srini up at the top, he worked on Apache Mesos, which is where we got a lot of the information that we're going to present to you about their communities. Srini has previously also worked on Docker. He currently works on Kubernetes. He spent a little bit of time in Cloud Foundry. So, you know, he's been doing quite a bit of open source work in this area. And then down here we have Jay. Jay also was a Mesos contributor, which is why we've gotten his input. He's based out of China. He used to work on Cloud Foundry at the very beginning, then switched over to Mesos, and then currently he works on Hyperledger Fabric. So if you have any questions about Mesos that we can't answer, those are the people you need to talk to. So let's kind of organize our discussion for the day. Because we're talking about three different projects, we want to kind of give an outline of what we think is important to take and make sure you understand, and then that way it makes it easier for you to kind of compare against the three. So we're going to start off telling you guys just some basic facts about the projects. This is going to be, you know, who are the people involved, how many contributors, commits, that kind of information. Then we want to focus on day-to-day. So if you're a contributor to these projects, what does that mean? What are you involved in? What are you committing to? What are your hours kind of thing? And at the very end, because we think it's really important that, you know, all of you who are using these products, we want to make sure you're enabled to go and contribute back to the ones that you like. So we want to give you an idea of how do you start in any one of these. So let's start with Apache Mesos, because we are at an Apache conference. So Mesos is part of the Apache Software Foundation. It is written in C++. It is Apache 2.0 licensed. 290 contributors. This is just statistics that are coming off of GitHub. So you can take those statistics how you want to. In about the last year, it looks like about 2,600, a little bit more commits. And then the last thing, and I think these are kind of the cool things, because open source, it's all about collaboration and kind of bringing things from these projects and spreading it out to everyone. So the first one is CSI, which is the Container Storage Initiative. So I believe Mesos was a big part of coming out with that spec, which is very cool. Then you also have LibProcess, which is a actor model messaging library, I believe, which is written in C++. So that's just like a general overview of Mesos. So let's kind of talk about how does code actually get developed in these communities. I'm going to kind of jump around a little bit in these orders, but this is the type of things that you want to kind of pay attention to, in my opinion. In Mesos, there's a few different levels of coders or contributors, maybe that's the better word. You have committers. So committers are people who have full write access to a repo. So they're able to just commit directly in. And then maintainers, they already have that access because they would have had to be a committer beforehand. But then they also kind of have added responsibility. The idea of them is they're managing a module or a part of the project, and they're kind of in charge of what does the design look like, helping people get through, giving them reviews, approving them. There's a whole set of responsibility associated with them. And the idea is, as a committer, even though you have full write access, you should only be using that privilege when you're making trivial bug fixes or trivial commits. And then the maintainer should be consulted for anything a little more complicated. So usually, let's kind of go from end to end. What would happen if you have a feature request, right? You have a feature request, you have something you want to get in, you would talk to a committer usually, and you would say, hey, this is a thing that I want to get in. Maybe you already have some code, maybe you don't, but you want to talk about it. And the committer is going to bring it up in what we call the PMC, which is a project management committee. So all the committers to a certain submodule or project are part of that PMC. And for a feature to get through or approved, what happens is the PMC is going to vote on it. And if it, you know, majority says, yes, we like this feature, let's go ahead with it, then the maintainer who's associated with whatever piece that you're going to touch or you're going to affect, they're going to help you drive the feature till the end. They'll look into, you know, they'll be there working with you on the design, making sure that enough reviews are going through and give you their input, and then help you merge it in at the very end. Now, that's kind of like the overall flow, but right, this is all collaborative. You want to work with people. What they also have is working groups, which are basically, they're formulated for two reasons. One is like this feature. Like if you have a feature that you wanted, you would have brought it up in a PMC, and that notifies people, hey, somebody's working on this. Let's all of us come together and work on this problem together. So that's one way a working group can be formed. Another way a working group is formed is just a group of people who are trying to talk about ideas, and they don't have a direct feature at the moment, but they just want to have a line of communication. And all these meetings are public, which is nice, which means anybody can join once they, you know, they find out about it. And I think all of them are on Google Docs that you can access off of the Mesos community website. So let's say you have a working group for the feature that you're proposed. You're working on it. You're created a design. But as I mentioned before, maintainers play a really big role in trying to get a feature in, looking at the design and helping you. What most of the maintainers work for a company called Mesosphere. And what they've done is they created a weekly time slot, basically, that you can come face-to-face with the people at that company. And you can go and meet. And since the maintainers will make sure that slot is open, you usually schedule in saying this working group is going to go talk to so-and-so, and those are counted, they're called face-to-faces. And the idea is when you go there, you can make use of that time to create some design proposals, kind of get the input from the maintainer, because in the end, you need their approval when your stuff goes in. So I think that's about the general idea of how work kind of gets done in Mesos. The last thing that I did want to note is kind of the tools. What are they using? So everything is tracked through Jira. So you should be able to see the issues. You can see what's open, that kind of stuff. And then for reviews, they use Apache Review Board. So the code, you know, when you push or when you're sending in a PR, it's actually going to go through that process. And those are the tools that people are using. Now, this is for people who are already kind of in the community or they're dealing with the community and they're writing code. But what about if you want to join? How do you start? If you go to the Jira that they have, basically they tag everything as newbie issues, which makes it really easy, right? These are tagged based on the idea that they're easy to understand, and they'll also give you a good knowledge base on the project itself and the component, which is good. The code styling is very important, so maintainers will guide you through your first issue commit, making sure you have the right style down and how to end-to-end get you there. And so as I said, I think if you look through this whole project, maintainers are playing a very big role in kind of policing the environment, making sure code looks good, and making sure features get in. So then next up, I'm going to give it up to Morgan, and he'll talk about Kubernetes.
Super. Thank you. Kubernetes, maybe you've heard of it. This is a container orchestrator. All of the projects today are sort of container related or cloud application related. Kubernetes is a very, very large project. Primarily it's written in Go, but there are many additional sub projects that have taken initiative to do their own thing if they don't require to talk to the API, or if they don't have to interact directly with Kubernetes. They interact with some other program that interacts with Kubernetes for you. Everything's Apache 2.0 licensed for the most part. There are individual projects that have come from companies and been contributed in that have started out license one way and generally try to conform to what everybody else is doing in the ecosystem. Everything is under the CNCF, Cloud Native Computing Foundation, which is a sub foundation of the Linux Foundation. It's really hard to get accurate sort of statistics on what do you consider Kubernetes and just the breadth of it. So there's dozens of GitHub projects. There's three or four different major organizations in GitHub that each have dozens of projects. So keeping track of all of this is difficult, but there are definitely thousands of active contributors. There's definitely lots of use of Kubernetes by all the major cloud vendors. And what's come out of this is a lot of work to try and get everybody on the same page in terms of managing containers. So earlier we talked about CSI, container storage. CNI was one of the big conflicts with Docker, where they did lib network and Kubernetes went container networking interface. And then one of the more important recent ones is the CRI, which basically says, okay, we're going to be abstracted above Docker, but the interface we're going to talk to could be Docker, could be RunC, could be Containerd, could be a thing they created called Creo. But basically everything, we want to try to make sure everything is OCI, open container standard, and then the runtime standard being the runtime CRI. So it's a very, very large, very diverse project. And I'll talk about the work in the governance now. So since everything is sort of organically grown from the beginning, there's a lot of diversity in how each project behaves. So there's a lot of different projects, and they're not all exactly the same. Any of the projects who sort of started out outside of the main Kubernetes/Kubernetes repository on GitHub have sort of grown themselves organically. So there's the case that yes, Kubernetes is now writing lots of process documentation, and everything does, in theory, fall under the, you know, the direct sort of rules of the main Kubernetes repository, the main Kubernetes technical steering committee. They're the top level, and sort of any sort of disagreements should basically rise up to sort of be solved by them. But they do have the, you know, the sort of the general lazy consensus. You know, we send an email just to make sure that we're making a decision, and then, you know, you give it a couple of weeks for everybody to object. But basically, you can assume that, you know, the standard, you know, consensus sort of protocol happens there. So there's inside of the Kubernetes repository is much code, like hundreds of thousands of lines of code. So there's actually sort of everything's been split into sub-projects that they're trying to break out of that repository and through their own separate sub-repositories. But these are all owned, these separate sub-projects are all owned by something called a special interest group, which is everywhere referred to as SIG. So, you know, all the SIG, all the API stuff goes under SIG API. All the security stuff, there's a SIG, like, authorization. All the main architecture decisions, there's a SIG architecture. And that's sort of the, that contains a lot of the top level people who have been there for a while and basically are trying to sort of guide the project in how they envisioned it from the beginning. All these SIGs have meetings, and so a lot of my day being involved in Kubernetes was, okay, wait, do I have a meeting today? Which meeting do I have? When is it? You know, is it at a time that, you know, makes sense for me? A lot of them are scheduled so that you get, you know, West Coast, East Coast, and Europe. There's been some difficulty to get Asia Pacific time zones involved, but, you know, they are trying to do that. So we do, they, you know, the community does want to open up and be accessible to everybody in all the different time zones, such that they'll schedule them, you know, alternate weeks, some stuff like that. After that, well, how do I get work done? Everything is done through GitHub. So, you know, if I do code, I file a PR. If I want to take an issue, there's issues. It's GitHub issues. But all of this is driven by automation. So there are bots, there are programs that look at the issues, look at the labels. They let you add, you know, comments to the issues, and that will say, okay, give me, you know, assign the issue to me. Sort of the impedance mismatch between GitHub and all the authorization is that some, you know, you have to be part of a GitHub org to be assigned an issue. So the first thing you want to try to get access to is the actual GitHub stuff. I'll talk about that in a second. But everything is straight Git, straight GitHub. There's not a lot of extra process beyond that, but you have to learn how to use the bots to manage your PR, to manage your work. You'll have, you know, once you put a PR, bot will come through, label everything, it'll run all the tests, and you want to get reviews from people, and you might have to go bug people because, at least in the past, the Kubernetes repository was, you know, thousands of PRs, thousands of issues outstanding at every time. And so there was a lot of traffic, and most people just turned off all of their email alerts that related to GitHub because they were getting hundreds and thousands of emails. I've recently turned that off, and it's amazing. I can actually read my email again. Let's see. That's about that for the work gets done. Let's go to the participation. And so part of participation is understanding how the governance and the automation works, but in general, what you want to do is you want to find an area that you think you can contribute to or you're interested in or your company's interested in. Maybe you use Kubernetes and you have a bug. You know, try to go find the SIG that would own that area. Join their meeting, show up, introduce yourself, say hi. You know, get your face name onto the video so that people can, you know, see you and meet you and get to know you. Because, you know, this is a social environment, you know. Then you want to try to find an issue. You want to try to find somebody who was on the meeting, get their attention to, you know, assign you an issue, even if they can't directly do it in GitHub. And you want to, you know, try to tackle issues, file PRs, get them reviewed. You want to go in, you want to review people's PRs, have comments. There's lots of open documents to view and comment on and make sure that everybody's making sort of the right decisions for everybody. At which point you will hopefully, there's a document now that lists the exact process of how to become a member. You want to get a couple of issues filed, a couple of documentation things filed, a couple of PRs in, and then you send an email to a, actually they changed that process. It's not an email to a mailing list anymore. It's a, you go to the forum, I think, now, and you find somebody and you tag them, and then they add you to the GitHub organization, and now you have GitHub access, and that makes everything a lot smoother because now the bots will recognize you, and you can tell them to do things, and they will do them. But once you get that basic permission, a lot of stuff is very open. Once you're inside, it's very open, and you can start LGTMing commits, PRs, and so that's the process. There is what? Oh, the process there is that your PR needs to get an LGTM from somebody, and then it needs to be approved by a specific person who's in a file in GitHub. So that's how they're trying to get around the sort of the ACL distortion there, where you're in GitHub but you're not allowed to do something, or you're allowed to do something but you're not in GitHub. They have an actual set of file permissions in the actual Git repository, and that's what the bots use to determine if you're allowed to make a contribution, merge the contribution, and then everything goes through CI and will be automatically merged, usually as part of a group of PRs, because there's so many PRs outstanding that they've had to resort to this like grouping of PRs and testing them in batches. Once you're a member, you're on a good track. There are sort of extra levels above. If you're a major contributor and major sort of leader in a SIG, you can become the actual contact point for that SIG. You can help drive sort of the strategic direction of the SIG. Other than that, the documents are open. Anybody can go in and say, look, I want to talk about this on the next meeting. And then when that comes up in the meeting, it's your turn to talk. It's your time. You're allowed to go into the document and add your issue. But since I talk about the SIGs a lot, it's important to know that is really the core grouping of people resources, in that there's not sort of an overarching person coming down all the time and saying, we're going to go in this direction for this specific issue, and then all the SIGs band together. It's each SIG, it's very organic, it's very self-directed. Each SIG is deciding what they work on at any time. They're all sort of little fiefdoms, and some have better people running them than others, and so you want to watch out for that, but it's a very direct and personal relationship you're going to form with the people in the SIG at every point in time. I think that's about it for this, and we will go to...
So Cloud Foundry is going to be very different from the previous two, so hopefully I'll get all of it down. So Cloud Foundry is part of the Cloud Foundry Foundation. This is not where it started off. It was a internal project at VMware. They had it, I think they started around 2011 is my guess. Initially, the whole thing, I think, was written in Ruby. And the reason was the creator literally was like, hey, there's this new language, Ruby. It's really easy to develop things. Let me try this whole thing out. If you've seen him talk later on, he does say, maybe I shouldn't have written everything in Ruby. But that we kind of are stuck with that in some of the pieces, which is why Ruby is one of the languages that I have up there. Cloud Foundry then from VMware got moved into Pivotal, which was more of a consulting kind of company, and they had a very different kind of development methodology. And a lot of Cloud Foundry's practices and everything come from Pivotal. And then around 2014-15, I believe, Pivotal gave Cloud Foundry or donated that, and they created something called the Cloud Foundry Foundation, which is now which houses this project. The Cloud Foundry Foundation is a part of the Linux Foundation. The main components are written in Go, Ruby, and Java. So Go basically covers from routing, the actual runtime. Routing, runtime, I think those are the big things. And then Ruby, we have our API, or our cloud controller, as we call it. And then Java is our authentication. So those are our three kind of big things. There are other pieces into it, logging, metrics, all of that stuff is written in Go. So if you're like, you're interested in this project, Go is probably the skill you need the most. This is also Apache 2.0 licensed. In terms of Cloud Foundry as a foundation, there are 7 platinum members. So your membership kind of affects the influence you have in terms of the direction, the features that get in. The 7 platinum members, I'll see if I remember them all, but it is Cisco, Dell EMC, VMware, Pivotal, SUSE, IBM, let's see, do I have them here? SAP. Those are the 7 platinum members. I don't think those have changed recently, so but those are the people who are obviously mostly invested in it, and that comes from not just, you know, money, but it also the number of people there that are contributing to this project. These numbers might be a little bit off, but about 2,700 plus contributors. You can see quite a few number of commits in the last 2 years. And when we were talking about specs and standards that are coming out of these projects, the one that Cloud Foundry kind of was the home for and that we worked in the last year to kind of bring out to other platforms is the Open Service Broker API. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the technical thing about this, but Cloud Foundry, when they started the whole thing, if you're used to the Heroku model of pushing your app code and it takes care of everything, that's kind of what Cloud Foundry does. But when they were designing the system, they said, you know what, people like services. We need to treat services as a first-class citizen in this architecture. So we created an API, basically something that any service provider can implement, and it will easily connect to it, the Cloud Foundry platform, and then it puts all their credentials and everything. It helps makes it easy to connect services to your applications, basically. And we've broken that out into its own API now. There is Open Service Broker API. The key kind of projects is Cloud Foundry and Kubernetes that kind of work together to pull that out. And those are also the two big implementations of it. So Cloud Foundry has one, Kubernetes has one. I believe OpenShift has one, but that's also kind of Kubernetes type of a system. So let's talk about what is the day-to-day like. I'll start off with meetings. Now, this is, again, a lot of the influence, a lot of the development style comes from Pivotal. So I'm going to kind of try to give you that background. Pivotal as a whole, they like to reduce the number of meetings an engineer has to go to. They say meetings are disrupting your productivity. You should only have to go to the meetings you have to go to. You shouldn't need to be in 100,000 different ones. So the meetings for all of the Cloud Foundry projects are kind of very simplified. You have one meeting usually on Monday or Tuesday that's about to talk about the work that should be achieved in the week. You have a meeting at the very end of the week on Friday, which is talking about a retrospective. Basically, what went well, what didn't go well, what do we need to discuss as a team? And as you can hear, these meetings are very, you can't have the entire Cloud Foundry contributors all in these two meetings. How it really works is you're divided into teams based on the piece that you're working on. And these teams are kind of closed off. So you can't just join whatever you want. You have to dedicate full-time contribution. So this is not something where you can kind of say, hey, I want to help Cloud Foundry out a little bit this week. It doesn't work like that. You need to say, I'm going to be there 8 hours a day for a long period of time, 6 months, a year. That's the kind of expectation they have. And these meetings are also closed. So we don't let anyone just come into them. We want them to be small. We want them to be productive. And we only want the people who need to be in them there. An important thing about these meetings, there is one every day before the day starts. It's 5-10 minutes. And the biggest thing that comes out of that is who are you working with that day? All development is mostly done through pair programming, which means you get partnered up with somebody every day, and you work with them 8 hours a day. So if you're remote, That means you have headphones on for 8 hours a day and you're sharing a screen. Because of this pair programming, though, remote working is not as much encouraged. Now, as other companies have been involved in the project, and because all companies are not based in San Francisco, this rule has been a little loosened up a little bit, but the idea is, as much as they can, they would like you to be in person working with them. And you usually can go up to the Pivotal offices and work there. They have open computers there. It's a very cool setup. What they have there is you have a desktop, you have a monitor connected to it, you have two keyboards, one mouse, but it's all the same screen. And it is quite a bit of work, so for people who are not used to it, it is mentally challenging, especially at the beginning. You don't know who you're going to work with all the time. You won't like everyone you work with, but you get really good at being productive and talking with someone and working through your ideas. The other thing, so I was mentioning that all of these are teams. How it works is each team has one PM. Maybe they have a second PM, depending on what the workload of the PM is. And they're the ones who kind of dictate what are the work items that have to be created. They'll create it. They also, at the very beginning, that morning 5-minute meeting, they kind of say, today we're going to have this track of work and this track of work. These are the we need pairs on this. We need two here, one here. They kind of dictate that. And they kind of control the priority of what gets done. And the idea is a PM gets to say what features need to be worked on. The engineers get full say on implementation. And all the engineers on the team, they get full write access. There's no review process. The idea is if you're pairing with someone, you already have two eyes on the code. You don't need a third. So you push directly in. Everything is TDD'd, which is test-driven development, a very big focus. So if you look into a lot of the code bases, you'll see the tests are probably a lot more code, lines of code are in the tests than they are in the actual component. And then everything is integrated with CI/CD. It's a constant process. Usually the way it works is there's a development branch. You push directly to the development branch. Once it goes through CI/CD, it gets into what we call the release branch. And then the PM has to go and accept each one. So they say, oh, these were the features that came in. Let me go and try to accept them. And then if, you know, anything goes wrong, they go back and say, hey, nope. This issue needs to still be fixed. And you kind of go through that whole process. And then once it gets accepted, it gets moved on to master. And then whenever the PM decides that they want to make a release, they'll cut a release and it'll be tagged at that point. So that's kind of like the day-to-day. As I said, it's a very much an agile kind of a work environment. They really thrive on feedback. They want feedback. They want people to say what's wrong. And then they also want people to just kind of, they want to remove the distractions as much as possible. That's kind of how it works. In terms of PRs, get from the community, people who find bug fixes. Each morning, one pair is usually dedicated as the community pair. What that means is we have a Slack channel. They're the ones who house any questions that are coming in from the community. There are people who are using it, people who find bugs, all sorts of stuff. We have a pair who usually make sure that they talk to them, get their ideas. If there is an actual problem, they will file the issue for them, make sure somebody's looking at it. And then the other thing is those are also the people who they will look at the pull requests that are coming out from the community. But if you want to make a very big impact in this community, kind of working from the outside is probably not the best way. You do need to dedicate the time. You need to be part of a team, and you need to dedicate the eight hours. So to the next point, feature requests and the PMC. So where do these feature requests come from? How does this direction kind of get told? We have PMCs for each of the components. So there's a runtime PMC. There's a services PMC. We have something called an extensions PMC. The extensions is basically side projects that are associated with Cloud Foundry, but they aren't actually part of the Cloud Foundry environment. So it's kind of like our incubator area. And in there, the extensions one is probably where the PMC probably has the least amount of influence on the direction of the individual projects underneath. But the other ones, for example, the runtime, which is where most of Cloud Foundry's projects come under, the PMC is the one who decides what features, what direction they're going to, and then they will talk to the PMs of the teams involved and say, this is what I want. You guys need to go and make the priorities for it. Now, if you're coming in and they have a cab call, basically once a month they have an open phone call where anyone can join and they can say, hey, I have this feature request, this is my proposal, I've gotten all these reviews, I want to move forward with it. And the PMC basically decides and says, okay, you know what, I agree with you, I see a lot of feedback, customer feedback, that this is kind of appropriate, let's go ahead with it. And once that happens, and as I said, they go and they talk to the PMs and then that follows through. And then once it gets to the PMs, the engineers on that team will work on it and they'll kind of work at the speed depending on what other things that they're prioritizing with it. Now, all the issues are publicly viewable. They're on Pivotal Tracker, so you can go and you can see, but you can't add yourself on it. It's not like GitHub. It's the only people who can add themselves onto those issues are people who are part of the project. And then we do GitHub review. If you submit a PR or if you submit an issue, you can still use that process. Anything that you submit onto GitHub, though, will automatically get tracked into Pivotal's tracker. So the idea is that you have one unifying place to see all where everything is, and you can make priorities for it. So how do people participate? So I mentioned before, this is not meant for people who want to just send a PR here and there. It's not very flexible like that. Usually you need some kind of employer support to go here. Because you need to spend 9 hours a day in this. This cannot be a side job. They want full commitment. And the way it works is once you get accepted, you have to take a test. Because you're pair programming, they want to make sure you're compatible with that. You are able to pair with someone. You're able to say your ideas. Communication is very important. If you pass the test, then they look around and they see what teams need help. That along with what your employer probably is looking for support in. And they'll place you on a team. Then you go through a 6 to 12 week dojo. We call it a dojo. Basically, it's 6 to 12 weeks where you immediately start working on code. But you're pair programming, so the idea is you kind of ramp up very quickly. You make progress. And in 6 to 12 weeks, the team kind of does a little bit of an evaluation on you. Usually, there's no problem here at this point. But after that period, you're considered a full committer. And the idea is if you were to work alone, you would be able to contribute code that would fulfill all the guidelines that they have. Other than that, if you do, you know, if you don't, you're not willing to spend or you can't spend, it's not like we would, Cloud Foundry does not accept PRs. They do. If you see issues, they will accept it. There is a limitation, though, so if it's a very big feature or a very big change, they might say, no, we would prefer our team handle this. But some of the other smaller bug fixes and things like that, they're very open for people to come and submit. You just will not be working at the same speed as everyone else, so you might have to be a little patient with them. So I'm going to hand this back to Morgan so he can kind of talk about IBM Cloud.
Okay, so this is the part where I talk about we use all of these things, and so this is why open source participation is important to us. Us being IBM, again, we're all speaking our own opinions. At all points, all of these projects are being used inside of IBM. They are being contributed to because we need to improve them because they make up part of the services we provide. We have a Kubernetes service. We, you know, provide that to everybody to use, and we need to make it better. So, you know, for our own purposes, but that leads to contributing upstream code. It's a lot easier to have patches merge into upstream than it is to carry patches forward forever. We have a service based on Cloud Foundry. There's an endpoint, and you can CF push your app, and it goes up to what I keep hearing is one of the biggest Cloud Foundry instances that exist. So we hit scaling problems that Pivotal doesn't even know about. They don't even see it because they haven't run one that's big enough, what I've been told. Mesos, at one point, there were Watson services that are were running on Mesos. I don't know if that's still true, but that was the original, you know, use case for that. We don't contribute a lot to it anymore, but you know, we did because, again, we were running it, we were using it. You know, these are all important things to us, and we encourage, you know, companies who use projects to, you know, contribute time and developer time, you know, back to the project, especially if you have a problem. Almost certainly somebody, this is like being in class. If you have a question, somebody else probably has the same question. If you have a problem, somebody else is probably hitting the same problem. You know, you don't want to go into a community and force your solution in, and you do have to, you know, sort of learn to play nice, but, you know, you build up this goodwill by doing contributions that don't really have anything necessarily to do with what your specific need is. Like, my job is basically go into a community, make the community better, make the code base better, not, you know, the majority of my time is not spent doing IBM features. It's spent just working in the community. This is a link. This does DNS resolve. So you can type it into your phone, and that takes you to our cloud. There are many other services that we have that we provide that are open source based. OpenWhisk would be the big Apache one that comes to mind. But we have contributors to Node.js. We have contributors Node-RED. We have contributors to many other projects that, you know, if I spent time listing here, it's just kind of a waste of time. But it's very important for everybody to contribute back. It's very important for the corporate sort of sponsorship to happen, I think. So, missing anything? Nope. So here's just some references. If this is, you know, you want to see the various projects, Kubernetes has a website, Cloud Foundry has a website, Mesos has a website. And then the last thing we want to leave you with is sort of just a vague chart that sort of recaps some of what we talked about. We're not going to go through it. If you want to guess, take a picture, you can take a picture. We'll try to put the slides online somewhere. But, you know, hopefully during this whole process of us speaking about each of the projects, you've seen at least some correspondence between what we've talked about in each project with each other project. So that's the goal, to give you an idea of what you might want to contribute to, what you might want to look for, and give you our experiences, our personal experiences to you, so that you can hopefully have your own experience and a good experience in open source. Ta-da.
So I won't be able to speak too much about Mesos. I just have the override. I understand that it's a container orchestration. I can speak much more about Cloud Foundry versus maybe both of those, Kubernetes and Mesos. They're all kind of focused on different types of developers and things like that. So for example, I believe Kubernetes and Mesos are a little bit more primitive, isn't quite the right word, but in the sense that the person who's using those services have to control more pieces. They have to understand the container that they're running. They have a little bit more of a manual workload or manual stuff. While Cloud Foundry, it's easier for someone who's just starting out. And the idea is Cloud Foundry is meant for the developers, but as from an operating standpoint, right, a developer is not going to stand up Cloud Foundry. As a developer, I can go and stand up a cluster, a Kubernetes cluster, but I would not do a Cloud Foundry. That somebody else should be hosting. And then it's meant for people who want to just push code. They don't want to care about it. They don't want to know how it's run. They don't want to manage it, basically. And Cloud Foundry does that, which also means that you can't customize as much, right? So those are your trade-offs in terms of what the different things are doing. Again, I can't speak specifically about Mesos. I can find out about it and maybe I can give that information to you later, though. But did that kind of answer your question? Well, it's hosted on our, so IBM has something called SoftLayer. It has our, this is where we get our VMs. We sell bare metal servers. We have Cloud Foundry hosted on our own cloud. And then the idea is for you, you would join IBM Cloud, right? And then you can push up your app to our Cloud Foundry instance. Yeah. No problem. Anything else? No? Okay. Thanks.